Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. On the engineering console is my compatriot, Egberto Willis, who does a show of his own Thursdays at 3 p.m. called Politics Done Right. Here we do politics okay, and we do other things as well. This will be sort of an open forum. I don't have a guest, so you can call and talk about pretty much anything you want, but I have a feeling I'm going to set the tone with my initial discussion. But it is basically open forum. The phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. I do prefer the number. I am a numeric person and not an alphabetic person. So we've had another act of white terrorism against black people in this country. There's nothing I can say that hasn't been already covered and overcovered by other media. But I did want to touch on one aspect of this. It's been 150 years since the end of the Civil War. Almost to the day, I think within the last several weeks, was like the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Civil War, the American Civil War, I should say, maybe. And, you know, I've always said there, well, always, for many years, I have said that there are, in my opinion, three versions of history. There's the winner's version of history, the loser's version of history, and the truth. And one of the, boy, I think I'm on the wrong headset here. Which headset am I on? Yeah, I'm not getting any volume. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying. Anyway, you know, people over time, nations over time, they tend to sugarcoat their history. Everybody wants to remember the good or great things that their people have done, and they kind of want to forget the not-so-great things. And then, of course, you've got the ideological bias. It's not even a matter of good or bad. It's a matter of right and wrong. One of the current fictions, and I use that term not so much advisedly, because, you know, the one of the mottos of this show is you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. And I think one of the fictions that has come to be created and perpetuated about the South and the Civil War is that it really had little, if anything, to do with the institution of slavery. Mostly what you hear is it was about states' rights. It was about federal oppression of Southern states, and they felt unfairly treated, and tariffs, and this and that and the other, and it was just peripherally about slavery. So they get into the states' rights things. I've mentioned before there was a, and may still be, a rest stop on I-45 near Huntsville. And it's about Sam Houston. And Sam Houston was the governor of Texas at the beginning of the Civil War, forced to resign because he was against secession. And it mentions this one guy, I think his name was Joshua Houston. And they talk about how he was a personal assistant to Sam Houston, and they became great friends. It mentions only really subtly in passing that he might have been a slave and he might have been freed by Sam Houston during the Civil War, and still became his paid assistant and good friend, and, you know, this whole story. But what fascinates me is the reluctance, the unacceptability of mentioning that this guy was a slave for some period of time. Now, Sam Houston, by all accounts, was a very enlightened slave owner, as such things went. And, you know, he treated his slaves well. Yeah, I've got Egberto making eyes at me. I'm just saying, okay, the perception at the time, assuming that all slavery is bad, some slave owners were worse than others. I mean, that's just people. But there is a speech that has come to be known as the Cornerstone Speech. It was delivered by the Vice President of the Confederacy, a gentleman by the name of Alexander Stevens. He did this speech extemporaneously, which is pretty impressive. It's close to 5,000 words, in Savannah, Georgia, on March 21st, 1861, before the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter. I have edited it down severely, about 80%. It still runs about 6 to 8 minutes, depending on how it's read. I have not had a chance to put the link on my website because my computer was giving me all kinds of agita, but it will be there. And I would strongly, if nothing else, look up the Cornerstone speech. I think that's pretty much all you have to say. Put that in quotes, the Cornerstone speech, and you should come up with some things. They have a fairly decent article on Wikipedia. I am going to do something I don't usually do, which is read this fairly lengthy excerpt, and I'm going to do it in probably what most people will acknowledge is a fairly poor, slightly Southern-flavored accent, just because I want to give it a little sense of verisimilitude and immediacy. If you want to call and get in line, we have open lines, and the phone number is 713-526-5738. I think we should talk about this when I'm done. So let's give it a listen, and you tell me what you think. Such views as I have to give, I wish all, not only in this city, but in this state and throughout our Confederate Republic, could hear who have a desire to hear them. We are passing through one of the great revolutions in the annals of the world. 7 states have within the last 3 months thrown off an old government and formed a new. This revolution has been signally marked up to this time by the fact that it's having been accomplished without the loss of a single drop of blood. All the essentials of the old Constitution, which have endeared it to the hearts of the American people, have been preserved and perpetuated. Some changes have been made. Some of these I should have preferred not to have seen made, but other important changes do meet my cordial approbation. They form great improvements upon the old Constitution, so, taking the whole new Constitution, I have no hesitancy in giving it as my judgment that it is decidedly better than the old. Allow me briefly to allude to some of these improvements. The question of building up class interests or fostering one branch of industry to the prejudice of another under the exercise of the revenue power, which gave us so much trouble under the old Constitution, is put at rest forever under the new. We allow the imposition of no duty with a view of giving advantage to one class of persons in any trade or business over those of another. All under our system stand upon the same broad principles of perfect equality. If Charleston Harbor needs improvement, let the commerce of Charleston bear the burden. If the mouth of the Savannah River has to be cleared out, let the seagoing navigation which is benefited by it bear the burden. So with the mouths of the Alabama and Mississippi rivers, just as the products of the interior, our cotton, wheat, corn, and other articles, have to bear the necessary rates of freight over our railroads to reach the seas. This is again the broad principle of perfect equality and justice, and it is especially set forth and established in our new Constitution. Another change in the Constitution relates to the length of the tenure of the presidential office. In the new Constitution, it is 6 years instead of 4, and the president rendered ineligible for a re-election. But not to be too tedious in enumerating the numerous changes for the better, allow me to allude to one other, though last not least. The new Constitution has put at rest forever all the agitating questions relating to our peculiar institution, African slavery, as it exists among us, the proper status of the Negro in our form of civilization. This was the immediate cause of the late rupture and present revolution. Jefferson, in his forecast, had anticipated this as the rock upon which the old Union would split. He was right. What was conjecture with him is now a realized fact. But whether he fully comprehended the great truth upon which that rock stood and stands may be doubted. The prevailing ideas entertained by him and most of the leading statesmen at the time of the formation of the old Constitution were that the enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature, that it was wrong in principle, socially, morally, and politically. It was an evil they knew not well how to deal with, but the general opinion of the men of that day was that somehow or other, in the order of providence, the institution would be evanescent and pass away. This idea, though not incorporated in the Constitution, was the prevailing idea at that time. The Constitution, it is true, secured every single essential guarantee to the institution while it should last, and hence no argument can be justly urged against the constitutional guarantees thus secured because of the common sentiment of the day. Those ideas, however, were fundamentally wrong. They rested upon the assumption of the equality of the races. This was an error. It was a sandy foundation, and the government built upon it fell when the storm came and the wind blew. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. This truth has been slow in the process of its development, like all other truths in the various departments of science. It has been so even amongst us. Many who hear me, perhaps, can recollect well that this truth was not generally admitted even within their day. The errors of the past generation still clung to many as late as 20 years ago. Those at the North, who still cling to these errors with a zeal above knowledge we justly denominate fanatics. All fanaticism springs from an aberration, I'm going to repeat that, all fanaticism springs from an aberration of the mind, from a defect in reasoning. It is a species of insanity. One of the most striking characteristics of insanity, their conclusions are right if their premises were. They assume that the Negro is equal, and hence conclude that he is entitled to equal privileges and rights with the white man. If their premises were correct, their conclusions would be logical and just. But their premise being wrong, their whole argument fails. I recollect once of having heard a gentleman from one of the northern states of great power and ability announce in the House of Representatives with imposing effect that we of the South would be compelled ultimately to yield upon this subject of slavery, that it was as impossible to war successfully against a principle in politics as it was in physics or mechanics, that the principle would ultimately prevail. That we, in maintaining slavery as it exists with us, were warring against a principle founded in nature, the principle of the equality of men. The reply I made to him was that upon his own grounds we should ultimately succeed, and that he and his associates in this crusade against our institutions would ultimately fail. The truth announced that it was impossible to war successfully against a principle in politics as it was in physics and mechanics, I admitted, but told him that it was he and those acting with him who were warring against a principle. They were attempting to make things equal, which the Creator had made unequal. In the conflict thus far, success has been on our side, complete with the length and breadth of the Confederate States. It is upon this, as I have stated, our social fabric is firmly planted, and I cannot permit myself to doubt the ultimate success of a full recognition of this principle throughout the civilized and enlightened world. End of excerpt. That was from a speech that came to be known as the Cornerstone Speech, delivered by Confederate Vice President Alexander Stephens in Savannah, Georgia, on March 21, 1861, before the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter. The speech is longer. It goes into a lot of detail. It talks about negotiations going on between the Union and the Confederacy and the hope that there may be some way to peacefully separate. It's an interesting speech. I think he makes a full discussion of the reasoning behind the secession of the Confederate States and the formation of the Confederate government. But I think that those who delude themselves, and there is no other way to put it, Those who delude themselves that the South seceded over states' rights issues that, if anything, had to do with slavery only peripherally, are deluding themselves. These were the words of a man contemporaneous to the time, heavily involved, personally, intimately involved in the secession and the creation of their new government, who would be involved in the war against the Union. This was a man who knew precisely what the South was fighting for. The South was fighting for the perpetuation of slavery and was confident that slavery would eventually win out in North America and perhaps the world. He goes on further in the speech to say that it was his conviction that that the Union would dissolve over its own internal conflicts, and that states that were formerly of the Union would eventually join the Confederacy and admit slavery. He was very confident in not only the survival, but the perpetuation and thriving of the institution of slavery. And he made no doubt as to what his views were of the Negro. The Negro was inferior. The Negro was meant to be enslaved. The white man was indisputably superior. This is what they were fighting for. Now, if someone who believes otherwise were to hear this show and perhaps call me, they might choose to say he misspoke, or I excerpted him out of context, or this was only a specific speech at a specific time and there was really a whole lot of other stuff and many other issues that were involved that he didn't touch upon. But based on this speech, which has come to be known as the Cornerstone speech, there is no doubt. There is no doubt that 160 years ago, they were fighting for the perpetuation of slavery. They believed in the institution and they believed in the rightness of the institution. And that is why, when you have states that fly Confederate flags, when you have cities that name streets after Confederate heroes, when you have a state like Mississippi where the state flag actually incorporates the Confederate battle flag, what they are doing is perpetuating the treason. And really, if you don't want to like fudge it a little bit, the treason of a rebellion against the honestly formed and democratically formed government of the United States of America. The Constitution provides for people to change that form of government. The South chose to secede and ultimately make war rather than try to democratically change what they wanted changed. You can argue about the rightness of their cause. You can. I mean, people can argue about anything. But this is the fact. You can have your own opinion, but you can't have your own facts. Just saying. Phone number is 713-526-5738. I would love to have a discussion about this. I think it's a really interesting topic. It is now about a quarter past the hour. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. My compatriot Egberto Willis is waiting for your phone calls. He's on engineering. I couldn't do the show without him. He's pretty much indispensable, because I can't work a control board to save my life. I did that on HD3, and man, I was awful. I suppose I could learn if I was, like, intensively trained, but at my current state of knowledge, man, I suck. I gotta tell you, seriously. 713-526-5738. I was gonna ask Egberto what he thought, but apparently I don't need to, because we have our first call. 713-526-5738. We do have some open lines. We've got a couple of callers coming in. Egberto is rapidly trying to sort them out and make them available to me. There was another article, and again, I apologize. I normally have an announcement for this show with links on my website at thinkwingradio.com or thinkwing.org. My computer was just messing with me today, and I was not able to get those in, but I will. So over the next day or so, I hope to put in an announcement where you can look at the links, where you can find the full version of this speech, which I think is a really important part of history. And I guess now we have Wayne. Thank you, Wayne, for calling. You will momentarily be on the air. There you go. How you doing tonight, Wayne? Did you hear the speech in its entirety?
Yeah, I listened to it, Mike. How you doing?
I'm okay. So what did you think?
Well, what I think is that any state that flies a Confederate flag in the South needs to go.
Okay, now wait a second. You're saying any state that flies the Confederate flag needs to go. You mean throw them out of the Union?
No, I said any state in the South that flies the Confederate flag needs to go. The flag needs to go.
Okay. Do me a favor. Turn down your radio, please.
Turn it down a little bit, baby.
There you go. Thanks, baby.
And she said you're welcome.
Ah, good.
Okay. All right. I don't talk to my woman no more.
Yeah.
All right, never mind. Never, because let's just keep going, man.
Yeah.
I don't see in this day and age, and just being a black man in the state of Texas, and knowing what the Confederate flag stands for, see anything that comes good of the Confederate flag. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
I was so elated when the Texas, I assume that's the Texas Supreme Court, ruled against
the license plates.
The license plates. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes,
because this was only, and I had a talk with some of my colleagues on the job, that was only going to instill hate in other people. You understand what I'm saying?
Well,
because
it doesn't instill it, but it validates it.
Yeah, validates it. I said,
in other words, it makes it more publicly. I mean, it's a gripe I've had against people like Rush Limbaugh, that Rush Limbaugh and his ilk brought back racism to a point where it became more socially acceptable.
Well,
and
I think
the license plate would have further contributed to that acceptability, that enabling.
They made it vogue.
They made it vogue.
Yeah. Well, I actually think that what we should start calling it, and we shouldn't label names, but we should call right wing radio, hate wing radio, that's all that they put forth. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
For lack of a better word right now, I can't say it. But that's all that right-wing radio puts forth is hate-wing radio. And there's nothing other than that they espouse other than hate. And Rush Limbaugh, Michael Berry, Sean Hannity, and all of those people, that's all they do, because they choose not to understand and accept what's going on.
Wait,
you understand what I'm saying?
I do. I got a couple of other callers, and I'm hoping.
No, hold on.
Okay.
I'm not through. I'm not through.
Okay.
I want to go to South Carolina tonight.
Really?
And I want to say this about those people that lost their loved ones up in South Carolina tonight. And I've been listening to a lot of talk shows, and I watched MSNBC and things of that nature, and how they portrayed it, and this judge that wanted to supposedly make a statement about this young man. But here's what I think, Mike, and everybody wants to say that forgiveness is a good thing. Well, there's nothing that I forgive about that young man. I mean, let me say that to you. But let me step back and say this before I say that.
Okay.
I'm a man that lost a sister. Okay.
All right.
I lost a sister and her boyfriend by the hands of my nephew. Okay. So I didn't kill both of them. So when people talk about forgiveness, you know, it brings something to my heart that I say that there, you know, people have to realize that there's, in some ways, there can be no forgiveness. because when someone does that to you and take away something that you love, which was my baby sister, I want you to understand that. That was my baby sister. And she was supposed to be here when I'm gone. You understand what I'm saying? But I was a lot older than her, and she ain't going to be here. So I'm here right now dealing with that. And the guy that she was with, he was a nice guy. He wasn't a bad guy. I liked him. You know, he was a pretty good fella. But my own family member did that.
Was he drinking, did he have like a mental break, or what was?
No, he didn't have a mental break. He was just an asshole, Mike. I'm just telling you, this is my nephew. I know him good, and I had talked to him and had several conversations with him about certain things in life that he shouldn't do. You understand what I'm saying? And I don't have any forgiveness for him.
Well, I'm just going to say this, and I understand, because I've often said that I do not believe in forgive and forget. I believe in forgive, but forgiving is as much for me as the other person. You know, it's like funerals are not for the dead. They are for the living. And I think forgiveness, to the extent you can offer forgiveness, is not for the guilty, but for the victims.
My sister didn't do anything wrong.
No.
Nor did the guy do anything wrong. So I don't have anything to forgive them. I don't have to forgive them for anything. You understand what I'm saying?
I think the forgiveness, if you could find it in your heart, and I'm not saying you ought to, okay? But I'm saying if you could find it in your heart to forgive your nephew, it might end up being some burden off you, irrelevant of how you feel about him.
Well,
because your mate.
Okay, I can understand what you're saying. And I will listen to you. But that's not going to happen, and I'm going to tell you why it's not going to happen, because the conversations that I had with him were about certain things and certain things in life and how to handle life, and he had the option to come to me and talk to me about those things, but he chose not to do that. But that's another thing. But forgiveness, and because I know that I had these conversations with him. You understand what I'm saying? I want you to understand what I'm saying.
I think so.
Because I know I had these conversations with him that I cannot forgive him. I cannot forgive him because I know that he was wrong in what he done. Okay? Now, what grieves me more is not forgiveness for him. It's the missing of my baby sister.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Because I don't have her here to talk to anymore.
I mean, I can't personally totally understand. I can intellectually understand. I won't pretend to know what you know.
But for those people to stand up in South Carolina and say they forgive a man that did something like a young man that did something like he did was it, to me, and this is me, and I'm not speaking for anybody else. It's totally unacceptable because there was nothing that those people done to him that will require him to do what he done to them. You understand what I'm saying, Mike?
I think I do. I think, though, yeah, I need to let some other folks go. But
you might need to let some other, because I don't think that anything that happens to this young man, let me say this, and I'm not going to hold you up long, but let me say this. I don't see, you know, people talking about this young man was sick because I know there's nothing, and if they want to say that, then let's talk about what some white folks are trying to change the Obama health care law. We could go into a whole lot of things, Mike, here tonight that would bring back those things, because if they want to say that this young man was sick, mentally ill, and things like this here, And he did this stuff under the influence of drugs or whatever, or mentally ill, well, then I would say to them, then why are we passing gun laws so that everybody can walk around with a gun?
Well,
you see, so you can't, we're not going to make light of what this white guy did. And if that had been a black man and they'd have brung him out, and do you think he'd have been alive today? If they had brung him out and he went into a white church and shot up a whole bunch of white parishioners?
Probably not.
We know not. Not probably. We know not. You understand what I'm saying? Sometimes I talk with y'all fellas and I try to.
What happened? Sorry, I think we lost Wayne. I apologize for that. I have only the deepest sympathy for Wayne. I understand what it's like to be consumed by a feeling of vengeance, a feeling of hate. And, you know, the only thing I could say to Wayne, and I'm not in a place to give him advice, but I hope he will forgive the people that he is angry at for forgiving the killer, because the forgiveness that they give the killer is not for the killer, it's for them. And they are still in shock, and they need to somehow come to terms and find peace with what that killer did in that church. So I apologize for having lost Wayne. I appreciate the intimacy of his call, and Wayne, do call back again. Okay, quick ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm Mike Honig. I also have Egberto Willis here on the control board. He's got his own show on KPFT 3 p.m. Thursdays, Politics Done Right. I think that Tim was up next. Tim, you're on the air. Thanks for being patient. How you doing, Tim?
All right, sir. I've been listening. I actually was driving into a parking lot of the store when I finally got my radio to pick up the station, and was quite mesmerized by the words I was hearing as you were reciting the speech. And, wow.
Yeah.
It was pretty impactful.
It is. And this is an excerpt.
I understand that. I understand that. And but it still was quite impactful to me. I just watched a movie last night that I'd never even heard of, Black and White, with Kevin Costner. If you get a chance, watch it.
I will.
It's extremely interesting. But the real reason I called was, as you were reciting this excerpt from the speech, I lived in Roanoke, Louisiana, when I was 12 and 13, and I'm now 65. During 1963, as the civil rights movement was going on and all, you know, here I am. I'm a dumb kid. Had been living in Virginia. We'd moved to the South, and you know, I knew that there was something strange. I did not really understand exactly what the heck was going on, because there was a school literally on the other side of the tracks in this little podunk town of 500 people. And then there was a school on the other side of the tracks, which all of us white guys went to, all of us white kids. And in the course of that, I don't remember exactly how it happened. All I remember is I sent a letter. I believe his name was Alan Ellender. He was the state senator in Louisiana, about how I felt about this whole issue. And I have a letter that he sent me back, and I think that you might find it extremely interesting to read that letter. I would be happy to email, send it to you.
My
print
email.
It out and bring it down to the Dern station and stick it in your box.
You can email it to me at thinkwingradio@msn.com.
At msn.com.
Yep.
Thinkwingradio@msn.com.
Thinkwingradio, all one word.
Yeah, because basically he was saying, well, I appreciate what you're saying, but you're not quite getting it, boy. And that's what he was telling me. And it just sounded so familiar when you were reading those words of that speech.
It really does kind of eliminate the ambiguity that modern Southerners have tried to place in the mythology of the Confederacy. I mean, this is plainly stated by the vice president of the Confederacy. There's no ambiguity about it. He makes it very plain what the main issue is, the main reason for the secession, and the fact that they believed that slavery was not only acceptable, but that eventually it'd be widely accepted in North America and around the world. It's very plain.
Well, you know, I get the question relatively routinely from different people that how do I feel about the way things are going on you know, how people, maybe they ask me directly how people in the South feel about all this, how race relations are going, or how, you know, bigotry, is there any progression of lessening of bigotry and racism? And basically I said, you know, how I see it, and you already got my age, so how I see it is that because it is not acceptable in the mainstream, or at least in the politically correctness society that has somehow come about, it's all still pretty much the same way it was. It has just gone underground.
But and underground,
people do not express it overtly as much, but it's still there.
But underground
there big time.
Is good, because underground means that they're not spreading that virus as virulently as they used to, because it's not discussed as much. People, of course,
I will agree with that. I don't mind that it's underground, and you get a whole lot better opportunities to challenge people on what they're saying or believing or acting out on. So, yes, it is better, but, you know, it is still extremely, extremely there.
I want to tell a story, because you and I are about the same age. I'm going to be 65 in January, so we're probably pretty close.
Well, happy birthday early.
I remember we used to go down to Florida from New York to visit my mother's parents. And when we made that drive, the interstate highway was still a new thing, and much of it, most of it perhaps, was not completed. So we did a lot of driving on county and state roads.
Right.
I remember there was one little blacktop two-lane road. We were going through a lot of country, literally like farms and stuff. And I'm going to use a word now, but forgive me. This is just the history.
Got it.
We passed a sign. I was probably about seven. Around 1958. I don't remember where we were passing through, but it was somewhere like Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, somewhere like that.
Okay.
And I saw a sign, handwritten, on a gate that said, no dogs, Jews, or niggers allowed. And I remember asking my father what that meant. And I don't remember his answer, unfortunately. What I remember is that he was really uncomfortable trying to explain it. That was normal. That was normal. It was normal enough that someone felt okay writing it on a sign. It was normal enough in Texas that they had a rock that said Niggerhead Ranch. Okay?
I know that.
I know you know that, because that was news in Texas, which is why I feel like I can say that reasonably safely. So the fact that that has become, you know, political correctness is a term that was actually given to what I consider being considerate of other people, was a term that was invented by the right. A lot of the terminology that everybody, including Democrats, starts to use is stuff that's originated by the wordsmiths on the right. And we're not careful about that. We're not careful enough about that. To go back to your point about racism being underground, you know, I feel like up until about the year 2000, roughly, I would tell people I felt like open racism had become about as socially acceptable as spitting on the sidewalk.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I also see a lot more spitting on the sidewalk.
The laugh is not really humor.
I understand. It's irony. Irony.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you go, Tim, unless you got something that you just want to wrap things up with.
No, really, that was it. And I will send you a copy of that letter as soon as I can access it in my archives.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate your call. And I'm right, glad that you found what I was reading engrossing enough that you were willing to sit in the parking lot and read it. And listen
to it. Absolutely. Now I go shop for my wife. So have a good night.
All right. The same to you. Okay. All right. We have open lines. The phone number is 713-526-5738. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and my compatriot Egberto Willis, who has his show Thursdays at 3 p.m., Politics Done Right. And, okay, Jerry, you're on the air. Jerry, how you doing?
I'm all right.
What's on your mind tonight?
Well, you know, you mentioned this, and what I remember is what I learned in my American political thought class in college. There was a few chapters on that whole thing, and there was a very big debate. There was a very big debate about whose basically socioeconomic system was better, you know, the slave South, or, you know, basically they came up with the phrase, or they started using the phrase wage slavery for what was going on in the North. Mm-hmm. And
are you talking now about the discussion in the books of history or the discussion in the class about the history?
I'm talking about the discussion in the books. Basically, we didn't really there wasn't too much discussion of it actually in the class, but
that's too bad.
You know, basically the instructor was lecturing and kind of like leading the class and going, you know, talking about different aspects of the debate that went on before the Civil War, basically, and even during part of it about. And, you know, basically what a bunch of Southern writers said is that basically our system was better than yours.
Yes. I mean, here it is,
and,
a speech from a guy who would know what it was about.
Yeah. And, you know, they actually argued that. And what they sat there and said was, and one of the reasons why you get a little bit of this in that movie, Gangs of New York, but, you know, lots of people who came over to the United States were immigrants, and they didn't want to fight in the Civil War. And one of the reasons why that changed around a bit is because what happened was, is they basically sat there and said, you know, we've got regular slavery down here. And, you know, basically things would go more smoothly and better in the North if basically there was a bunch of slaves up there, in essence. In other words, you know, if you had a big slave labor pool, basically you wouldn't have the kind of, you know, labor agitation or problems with labor or whatever that you've got. And what I find is most people don't really know the history of that. And that still opens up a wound for a lot of people, not so much on a racial level, but on a personal level, you know, because we still talk about wage slavery, of course.
You know, I want to talk a little about the Confederate flag and the evolution of feelings about the flag and about the Civil War. And you can start with something like Cecil B. DeMille's movie Birth of a Nation, which, of course, was really...
No, that was D.W. Griffith.
D.W. Griffith, sorry. I knew I had that name wrong. Sorry about that. D.W. Griffith. What was it, about 1912, 1917?
Yeah, that period.
And he made this lengthy film, unusually lengthy film, with an unusually large budget for the time, that really was very pro-Southern. You know, the Ku Klux Klan were the good guys, and the Northern Carpetbaggers were the bad guys. The black folk really were very, very simple and couldn't hardly survive without the white folk from the South telling them how to do it. Then you had some evolution. You had Gone with the Wind. I actually had not watched it. I mean, it's a four-hour movie, man. I just didn't want to commit that kind of time to it. But finally, a couple, 3 years ago, I watched the whole thing on Turner Classic Movies, and it was fascinating to me. Now, this was made about 1933, 35. And it was fascinating to me how sympathetic it was to the South. It wasn't pro-South, exactly, but it was very sympathetic to the South. And I guess the thing to remember is the closer you are in time to the Civil War, the more people who were alive at the time remembered being on one of those sides or the other, or having a relative who was, or a friend who was. And I think that there was, you know, business is business. And I think that there was a lot of thought about, for example, movie making, that if you're going to make a movie, you can't alienate half the country. So they had to be sympathetic to some extent to both sides. Now, I'll tell you that when I was a kid, I remember in the late 1950s, 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, you would be riding a bicycle, and they would sell accoutrements and decorations and things you could put on your bicycle. And a popular one, and one that I had, was a little array of flags on my handlebars that alternated Union, Confederate, Union, Confederate, Union, Confederate. And it's always important to make the distinction. This was not the Confederate flag. This was the Confederate battle flag. And there is a difference, which most people don't realize. And at the time that I did that, all it was a cool design. Because there was still, to some extent, that desire, which Lincoln expressed, to try to bring the South back into the Union, with charity for all, so that the wounds, to the greatest extent possible, could heal. And as time has gone on, as the last living memory of the period of the Civil War has died, and as the last living memory of the children of people who remembered the Civil War, who got those first-hand stories, have died, I think, and then when the battle flag came to be used as essentially a symbol of resistance against the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act, that's when it really became, for a lot of people, the equivalent of waving a Nazi flag. It was a symbol to advertise the hate and the lack of respect that some people had for other people. So, to some extent, the feelings toward the Confederate battle flag that is becoming increasingly, I'm going to use the word popular, which is probably the wrong word, but increasingly the case, let's say, I think that the people waving that flag have probably done it the most injustice by making the association, which it didn't entirely used to have. Any thoughts on that?
No, I think you're probably right. I think that certainly there was a revival of that. And I think you're probably right. There was probably a certain level of the symbolism there and all that. Basically what we did was Reconstruction ended in 1877. We basically dropped everything, if I remember correct, ended in 1877. We basically dropped all of our efforts to try to do anything really for African Americans, particularly in the South, but really throughout the country. After that, up until, basically about 1965 and all that. And, there's lots of, there's people who've written books about how basically, how slavery really didn't quite go away in the South, that there was lots of people who were working and
sharecroppers.
Yeah, sharecroppers, but also other people who were working and, there were like vagrancy laws. We still have those on the books even down here. If you're walking around and you don't have any money on you or anything like that, no fixed place to live or whatever, the cops take you in and everything. Well, that was a thing that was used basically to, in essence, to keep African Americans, particularly in the South, from, after the Civil War, from running around or doing whatever. And, you could basically arrest them and have them do whatever you wanted them to do or whatever.
Yeah, they become work gangs. I'm going to let you go, Jerry. I want to open up the lines for anyone else who might.
Yeah, sure thing.
Call.
That's fine.
I appreciate your calling. I thank you very much, and I'll look forward to speaking to you again. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. I've got my compatriot Egberto Willis on engineering. He does his show on Thursdays at 3, Politics Done Right. And we do have open lines, and we have about 10 minutes, 713-526-5738. I'd love to hear some other thoughts on this or other perhaps related topics. I think what I want to say about this topic of symbolism. The swastika, until it was appropriated by the Nazis in the East, was actually considered a symbol of good luck. It was an Aryan symbol because Indo-Europeans, Northern Indians, as a matter of fact, Asian Indians, are descended from Aryans. And it's interesting how symbolism changes over time. When I was very young, the battle flag was just a really cool thing. You have to admit, it's an impressive design. It's simple. I mean, it's a cross because of the Christian aspect. Yeah, Egberto is saying, no, I don't think so. But if you look at European flags that have those kinds of crosses, I mean, even looking at the Union Jack from Great Britain, it's got actually three different crosses symbolizing the three main nations of the United Kingdom. So you've got the cross, you've got the stars, which was a reference to their previous allegiance to the United States. And the development of the battle flag actually is kind of interesting. The actual Confederate flag had a blue field with stars, and I believe it was three stripes. So it had Red, White, Red. And the reason that it was developed as the battle flag, I forget which general did it, was because troops would often confuse the two flags. The actual Confederate flag was so similar to the Union flag that troops would run the wrong way when they had to retreat or rally around the flag. So you'd have, like, Union guys rallying around the Confederate flag, oops, and you'd have Confederates rallying around the Union flag, oops. So there was a general. He was considered one of the great generals of the Confederacy, if that isn't in the context of this discussion an oxymoron. And he came up with this extremely distinctive flag. And, you know, you got to give the guy an A for effort. He came up with a truly distinctive, simple, memorable design that has endured for over 150 years. Now, I suppose you could look at the Nazi flag the same way. It was simple. It was creative. It was adaptive. The Nazi flag. I hate to associate the Confederate battle flag with the Nazi flag, but I do have to say that there's no question that the Confederate battle flag has become associated, because of the way it's been used, with real hate. Okay, we have a caller on the line, Sean.
Hey, how are you doing?
How are you doing? You're on the air.
Good, and you?
I'm good, thank you. So what's on your mind?
Oh, I just listened to our past history with slavery, and just thinking about how how it's sort of being brought from way back to now, it seems to be a continuation of, you know, white man's guilt, where in the past the percentage of the slave owners a long time ago were not really Anglo-Europeans, but there were, you know, other Europeans, Spanish and Italians and Jewish. And
well, now, I'm going to dispute that. I mean, at that time, the reason that the term Anglo has become synonymous with white is because at that time, most of the colonists were Anglo-Saxon or, to some extent, German. There wasn't a lot of other, because they were British colonies. And you had a certain amount of immigration, but we didn't have the real immigration explosion until the late 19th century, after the Civil War.
But the slave owners in the Bible Belts weren't your typical, Anglo-European Saxons. They were, matter of fact, it was less than 10%. The folks that were, you know, it's a famous day on September 1683 on a Saturday.
I'm sorry, which 83, 18 or 19?
It was 1863, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And it was a Saturday. And Abraham Lincoln said a famous statement, "I won't free the black man to enslave the white man."
I'm sorry, he said what?
"I will not enslave the white man to free the black man."
Okay.
And what he meant by that was, on that Saturday, the British and French were pretty much getting ready to attack. And Alexander, Tsar of Russia, basically had all of his Atlantic fleet ported in New York and Pacific fleet ported in San Francisco. Not that Russia at the time had the warships that the French and the British had, but they had like tens of thousands of boots on the ground.
Well, it's worth noting that to the extent that the Union had the potential for conflict, particularly with Britain, was because of the mercantile issue of cotton. I mean...
Talking about the cotton trade route?
The cotton trade.
Was across the transatlantic, into London to Indies?
The Union government actually had to make it very clear to the British that they wanted hands off. The British were thinking of running the blockade that the Union had around the Confederacy. And as I understand it, they had to make a number of presentations to the British that if you aid the South, then that will mean war between the United States and Britain.
Well, that was part of it, but I think even a bigger piece was that this whole continent was supposed to be servitude. From, you know, the Bible Belt, even Canada down to Haiti, you know, the French did to the Haitians. Probably one of the worst examples of slavery. But this this whole continent was built. This republic was created to be for mercantilism, and the Transatlantic trade route was, you know, a dozen million folks lost on the ways over from the bankers that sent them over here. It's taught in other collegiate schools, but we won't get in our state yet, colleges or schools here, that we were created for that reason, to be a continent of slaves, and that's what Abe Lincoln meant on that Saturday.
I'm going to ask the Russians
was coined by a U.S. Army general that said that, because at that time we were the breakaway republic from the banks. So you're right in some sense, but it wasn't just for the Union and the control of the export. And we were created for that reason.
All right, Sean, I have one more caller that I want to get on before the end of the show. The email is thinkwingradio@msn.com. If you have any links you want to send me, I'd be fascinated to read them. And I thank you for calling.
All right, have a good night.
Take care. Okay, Johnny, you've got the last couple of minutes or minute and a half of the show. How you doing tonight? You're on the air.
Okay, I missed most of all what you said tonight, so I'm wondering if you covered this or not. In light of recent events in South Carolina, and considering our persistent problem with Republican obstinacy, I was thinking about the Lincoln administration and wondering if you have any take on this. Do you think the Lincoln administration, right after the end of the Civil War, or right before the end of the Civil War, do you think they gave too much autonomy to the leaders of the South, the Southern states, that helped contribute towards this type of ideological, unending problem that we have now, manifesting in Governor Haley finally coming around to ask for taking that stupid flag down, when just a few days ago she said it was too political, we weren't going to do this right now. She goes with the wind, and she's a problem, just like all the other Republican governors. I don't see how we're going to get our police to come in line if they take their cues from Republican governors like her.
Well, I think that, better late than never. I think it's nice that public opinion is reaching a critical mass where maybe this change, this belated change, is finally about to happen. I guess that at the end, it would be nice if the Mississippi flag took out the battle flag. We're kind of running out of time. So I'm going to have to let you go, Johnny. You know, call me next week earlier in the show, and we can discuss this at a little more leisure. I thank you. Have a great week.
I'll try.
Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and my compatriot Egberto Willis, Think Wing, KPFT 90.1 FM. And remember, union forever. Okay, take care. Have a great week.
KPFT Community Advisory Board is requesting your participation in a listener survey. The KPFT Community Advisory Board, also known as the CAB, is a vehicle for effective community input to the station's governing body about station programming, community service, and impact on the community from the station's major policy decisions. Community advisory boards assist stations in developing programs and policies that address the specific needs of the communities they endeavor to serve. KPFT listeners are welcomed and encouraged to participate in the completion of this survey. Please visit the KPFT website at www.kpft.org and complete the Community Needs Survey. Thank you for your help, and thanks for listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT, Houston.
Why donate your car to KPFT? You can free up space in your garage, you can avoid the hassles of selling your car, there's no need to pay hefty car repair bills, and you turn that unwanted car into an IRS tax deduction. In addition, you're helping to make the Houston area better with unique arts, music, and culture. You help keep options on the airwaves. Best of all, making a car donation is easy and always free. Just call 1-855-573-8227 or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Again, that number is 1-855-KPFT-CAR. Thanks for your help. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.